Okay, good morning everyone. Welcome to week four of the series that we're doing called Foundational Principles, based on the book called Witness by Ariel Berger, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom. We're going through every week a different topic because it's there's seven chapters there on seven concepts, which you're going through each one. And today's week four called Madness and Rebellion. Just before we continue, I just wanted to point out that next week, next Thursday, is Erev Shavuot. It's the day just before Shavuot, and therefore we won't be having a session, but we'll resume again in 2 weeks' time. So just a reminder, next week, no session. We'll resume again in 2 weeks' time. Just before we continue today's topic, just to spend just a couple of minutes reviewing, just a quick review of what we did last week. Last week we talked about the concept of faith and doubt. We defined faith as being something that's not rational, that actually reveals a deeper, supra-rational part of our connection, our conviction, connecting to something that's beyond us, which actually is a little bit connected to today's discussion as well. We talked that emunah, that faith, doesn't mean we don't have questions. We do have questions. On the other hand, the faith is something that's really part of our DNA. It's part of who we are. Just like Elie Wiesel explained, as something that he thought maybe it'd be easier if he didn't have, but he couldn't renounce it. We connected it to the concept of personal growth, explaining that personal growth really means you go beyond yourself. And you can only go beyond yourself if you go beyond your intellectual rationale, if you go beyond something that you understand and you connect to something, as we called it, outside the system. So it's something we all have and something that is just needs to be nurtured and worked through. And sometimes we have questions, and questions are good, particularly when they're on the foundation of faith. And they come from faith rather than trying to weaken the faith. And what our job, our mission really is not so much to build the faith, because we have that, but it's more to internalize it so we don't act in contradiction. I gave you that analogy of the ganef, of the robber breaking into a house and offering up a prayer to God to make him successful, which is obviously a contradiction in terms. That's what we call uninternalized faith. So those are some of the concepts which we explained last week. Now today, we're going to do a chapter in the book, focus on a chapter in the book, I should say, called Madness and Rebellion. Now, there's a lot in this chapter, and we're not going to be able to cover everything, but I wanted to take out and explore three concepts, which really become all connected. Now, you might not understand exactly right now what these three, where I'm getting to with these three concepts, because we haven't developed a concept, but just as an agenda item, so to speak, of explaining what we're going to go through. The three concepts are recognizing madness, how to recognize madness. Second is rebelling against madness. And third one is using madness to rebel. Okay? So it's recognizing madness, rebelling against madness, and using madness to rebel. So step one, okay, let's talk about recognizing madness. Step one is if we want to live in a world where our mission is to bring goodness to the world, to bring hope, to bring morality, values to the world, we need to understand that there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the world which is insane, meaning it is ridiculous, it is nonsensical, it goes to the depth of the antithesis of everything that we hold to be dear and valuable and moral. But the first step, and this is a danger, and it might sound obvious, but it's not obvious. The first step is never to normalize insanity, okay? But rather to recognize insanity, to recognize evil, to recognize immorality, to recognize all these things for what they are, okay? Why? Because actually, although we don't dwell on negativity, but actually we cannot fight bad, we cannot transform evil into good, if you first don't recognize what the evil is. You cannot become normal if you don't recognize what's insane. So let me just begin with a few excerpts from the book, actually. It talks about a classroom of Elie Wiesel, as it normally does. And it's a Monday morning in October of 2006, and he's giving a lecture. And the book reads, the author says, although he began his lecture with a discussion on the course reading, he's talking about Night. Night is, of course, the first book, I think, that Elie Wiesel wrote, in response to a student's question. And he says, Elie Wiesel says, there are things I did not write. They were too terrible to write, he says. How could I have seen what I have seen and remain sane? Years after these events, I asked my good friend who was also there, did I really see that? And he said, yes, I saw it with you. It's hard to believe. The mind can only hold so much absurdity. How did I remain insane? I do not know. And then he continues and he says the following. He says, the witness inhabits the world of madness. He sees what is happening with lucidity. But when he reports what he's seen, he appears to be mad. You see, people don't want to recognize madness. People want to shy away from madness. You know, I'll just give you a metaphor for this. I was just listening to a podcast and it was a therapist talking, and she said something interesting, which is an obvious thing. You know, we talk about the flight or fight mode when people get into stress. So if there's an impending danger or there's a problem, some people fight, some people run away. But there's a third thing they talk about, and that's called freeze. Freeze means you freeze and you just dismiss it, you detach from it. It's happening, but you pretend that it's not happening. And a lot of times people do that with what's going on in the world. There can be terrible things going on in the world, and the world freezes to the point where they won't recognize that insanity is going on, to the point where, as Elie Wiesel says, those who report insanity are considered insane. Right. He says, I wrote about this in my first book, about Moshe the beetle. Now what he means is Moshe the shamus. And someone asks, what's a beetle? So he explains, a beetle is someone who's in a synagogue, and you know, he does the caretake of a synagogue. He makes sure it's open, it's closed, it's clean, and so on and so forth. So he tells the story about Moshe the beetle. Who was Moshe the beetle in his shtetl? He came from a place called Siget, which was a very, very Hasidic, intense community. And Moshe was a person who had been deported, and he managed to return. He was the only surviving witness to the mass killing of Jews. And he reports the shootings, and he's disbelieved by the townsfolk of Siget. Young Eli is fascinated by Moshe. However, Moshe cries out, however often he bears witness, it is not enough. His testimony is ignored. By the standards of the sane people of the town, they could not believe such a thing could happen. He's mad. But the reader knows he's not. He's the sane one. It is the world that has gone mad. And one of the students in the class asks Elie Wiesel, he says, Professor, did you believe him when you were a child? And he answers, no, I did not. I could not have. It was too far beyond my imagination. But unlike the others, at least I listened to him for a simple reason. I loved stories. So he was coming back and he was telling the story, but no one believed him, as we know to be the case. Now, I know that was obviously, God forbid, without judgment, because that was so insane, it was actually hard to believe. But it's a lesson about being sensitive to these things, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But then the author continues and he says that it was Elie Wiesel's experience of the Holocaust that cemented his sense that the world was prone to madness, right? He discusses this at length. He says, how can we protect ourselves against this kind of madness? This is not just an abstract historical question. Listen to what he says. He says, all roads lead back to Auschwitz. If there is violence today, suicide, mental illness, it may be because 70 years ago the world did nothing when 6 million innocent people were slaughtered. And just one more excerpt before we discuss this. He says, among the many questions Professor Wiesel often put to the class was this. Was evil timeless, immortal? Did it precede humanity? Or was it born with Adam and Eve? Was Hitler evil before he was the Führer? Were only the killers evil? What about those who sent them? What about those who watched and did nothing? These are very, very thought-provoking questions, very difficult questions. So let me go backwards a little bit and try and discuss this and unpack this a little bit. So first of all, I think in terms of the last question, are people inherently evil? Was evil born together with Adam and Eve? Jewish writings, and particularly Jewish Calabus, would answer that no, it wasn't. It wasn't part of the essential humanity. It's not part of the... humanity is essentially good. Humanity is created. Human beings are created, but Tzelem Elokim are created in the image of God, as we've talked about many times. There's a spark within every human that's a soul, which is intrinsically good and human. It's a pure spark. And therefore, evil did not begin with Adam and Eve. However, you see, the reason that that's important before I go further is because if you believe evil is an intrinsic part of the human function, of the human existence, what that does is it breeds hopelessness and despair. If human is part of who we really are, if evil is really part of who the world is, if bad, if immorality, if evil, if being prone to insanity, as he calls it, is part of who we are, That's bad news. That breeds despair, it breeds despondency, it breeds hopelessness, because then there's no hope. I mean, if just it's part of who we are, we just need to accept it. But it's not, you see. Because if the default position of the human is bad, then we need to just give up. But we don't give up. Why? Because let me explain to you how it does exist from a Kabbalistic point of view. The Kabbalists explain that when God created the world and it was Adam and Eve who were created as human, as designs of God, they were on a great level. God simultaneously in the world created what we call in Kabbalist language the forces of klippa, the forces of evil, the forces of impurity, the forces of challenge, the forces of struggle. However, in the very beginning of creation, because God wanted these forces, because he wanted us to overcome them, but they were kept separate. In fact, the snake, the nachash, was the symbol. He was the encapsulating symbol of evil. But the Kabbalists explain that as soon as Adam and Eve failed and gave in to their temptation and brought sin into the world, it wasn't who they were, but what happened was everything became intermingled. Good and bad became a mixture. Good and bad became inseparable almost. And to use the Hasidic Kabbalistic terminology, ever since the very first sin until Mashiach comes, ain tov belo ra, ain ra belo tov. There's no good without bad, there's no bad without good. Right? So therefore, it is true, it is not part of the human experience, but it is true that it exists within the human. It exists within every person, within every culture, within every community, within every country. There is bad, there is evil, and it needs to be recognized. And we need to do three things. The first thing is we need to recognize it when it happens and not, God forbid, to normalize it. That's part of the test. The test is that sometimes we rationalize and we normalize things which are insane and immoral and evil, and that's our test and we shouldn't do that. And we'll talk a little bit soon how that's not only true on a global extreme level like the Holocaust, it's true within every one of our lives, right? The second thing is we should never be surprised when it happens because we shouldn't be taken by surprise. Part of the failure of what happened during the Holocaust and part of the failure of what happens in many instances of evil and could happen in our own private lives as well is that when something bad happens, we're taken so by surprise, we're overwhelmed, we're shocked, and we don't respond properly until it's too late. And the third thing is, we mustn't only recognize it and not normalize it and not be taken by surprise, but we must do something about it. And that's what we're trying to unpack and trying to see how this all comes together. Now, when I talk about insanity or evil or bad things which are just crazy, this is both globally and both personally, right? Elie Wiesel, what he does is he discusses different types of what he calls madness or insanity. He says there is clinical madness, which is destructive and which isolates and separates people. And then he talks about something called political madness, where nations go crazy, right? And then a student asks him, what do you mean by political madness? And he says, we have so many examples of political madness, especially in the 20th century. Two mass movements that teach us both about this is Nazism and communism. And he says an interesting thing. He says both were products of collective insanity rooted in individual madness. Hitler and Stalin were both filled with delusion and paranoia. It started with them. It was individual insanity, individual craziness, which then spread and it was contagious and spread like the virus, right? Spread and became a pandemic. It became a global thing. So insanity is not only something which is nationwide. Insanity starts with individuals, and the truth is it starts in small settings. And it needs to be recognized. And sometimes we don't recognize madness, just like we don't recognize global madness often. We don't recognize individual or community or small clusters of madness. I mean, it could be something like, teaching our children not to turn away from bullying that they witness in school. We shouldn't turn away from bullying, from people who humiliate other people. We shouldn't turn away from exclusion, from division, from disunity, all these things that often happen and we don't do anything about it, right? Now, sometimes it's very hard to recognize. Sometimes these things are very difficult to detect because they're very convincing. Sometimes these type of things put on a cloak, a garment of sort of sounding very normal and noble and so on and so forth. And sometimes just rampant and it's very hard to fight. But what we do need to do, as I said before, we need to recognize insanity. And as a first step, at least not to normalize it, right? Now, when I say recognizing evil in the world, I don't mean recognizing a problem. I don't mean to become negative and pessimistic. You see, on the contrary, if you're an optimistic person, okay, if you want to fight evil, if you want to fight for goodness, you want to bring good into the world, you want to bring morality into the world, you want to do things, you want to go against distorted values, evil values that are around us, and you want to bring good, as you want to bring light as opposed to darkness. You want to illuminate darkness by using light. In other words, your mission is optimistic, your mission is hope, your mission is really determination to bring greatness, goodness into the world. You actually have to recognize the bad first. If you want to bring light in the darkness, you have to know where the darkness is. If you want to bring good into evil, you have to recognize what is the evil that you're trying to transform. And in fact, real positive people, people, leaders that made a difference, leaders that transformed, or small leaders in their own small circles of influence that make a difference, they are never in denial. These are people that fully understand the problem. They don't look through in the world. They don't look at the world through rose-colored glasses. They're not in denial. That they're not in a cocoon. They are people that recognize the problems. They are people that really understand the problems of the world, and yet are determined to fight it. And yet understand that there's hope, and understand that there's determination, and understand that we can do something about it. And I'm going to tell you something. It's connected also to tomorrow. Tomorrow is the 28th of Iyar. It's the day, of course, the anniversary of the recapturing of Jerusalem during the Six-Day War, an unbelievable, miraculous event. The whole war was unbelievably miraculous, right? So I'm going to share with you something that's connected to Jerusalem, and it's something which is written by a former Knesset member who was originally a journalist, I think for the Ma'ariv, if I'm not mistaken. Her name was Geula Cohen. She's no longer alive, but it was an amazing piece. And she writes, I think, about something that happened in 1964. And you'll see why I'm sharing this with you, because in a very interesting way. She writes about an encounter, about an audience that she had with the Lubavitcher Rebbe in 1964. When she returned to Israel, she was a journalist at the time. She reported on the audience, and she intentionally left out part of what the Rebbe told her. You'll see why in a moment, because she couldn't. And it was only much, much later, when the situation in the world changed, that she decided to write about it. And she writes, it's a beautiful article. When she reports on it, she talks about how she was given an appointment. The Rebbe had this interesting system that he would see people at night. And the secretary told her that your appointment is 11 p.m. There was always a long line throughout the whole night. And she said, there's no time during the day. To which he answered, the Rebbe never sees people during the day. That's when he studies. That's when he answers people's letters and so on. Anyway, she describes the whole thing. And then she comes into the Rebbe. Now, you have to understand, I'm sorry, it wasn't 1964, when she came, it was just after the Six-Day War. Now, you have to understand what was going on there. After the Six-Day War, there was almost euphoria in Israel. Israel, among the nations, got a whole new respect. People were scared of Israel. You know, I've heard from people that when they walked down Shavuot, just after the Six-Day War, when they walked down to the Kotel, after being up a whole night, there was this awe, there was this respect, there was this pride, right? The Kotel was recaptured. We can visit the Kotel after so many years. Jerusalem is in our hands. It was just the most amazing, uplifting, incredible culture and feeling and atmosphere going on in Israel. And when Geula Cohen came into the Rebbe, and she had a very long audience about talking about different issues that were facing Israel and the Jewish nation, the topic came to talk about Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, and the Kotel and everything. And the Rebbe dropped a bombshell, which nowadays is not considered a bombshell. He dropped a bombshell and he said, I'm worried they are going to give Jerusalem back. And she writes, she just couldn't comprehend what the Rebbe was saying. It made no sense at that time. And it made no sense in the context. Everyone knew we just captured Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is now ours. It's beautiful. The insanity that goes on today, which now we know all too well. I think I told you this before. A few years ago, I was standing in the streets of Yerushalayim and I was visiting the tunnels of the Kotel and Ir David, the city of David. And it was the very day where UNESCO came out with this insanity, real insanity, of saying that these are sites that don't have an historical connection to the Jewish people. And I'm thinking, is this some kind of joke? I was standing right there. I was standing on a street that's 2,000 years old. I was standing next to King David's palace, which is 3,000 years old, looking at the pathways which Abraham 4,000 years ago traversed and traveled and so on and so forth. And craziness. And people buy it. People believe it. Just as people start to believe Holocaust denial, God forbid. Right? Totally insanity. But this was in 1967, just after the war, with such a notion was unheard of. And the Rebbe said to her, I'm worried they're going to give it back. And she thought it was so crazy that when she came back to Israel and she wrote about her audience by the Rebbe, she omitted that part. She said she just couldn't write that in an article. Wouldn't have been, they would have thought she's mad or this was just craziness, and she didn't want to do that. So she wanted to make the thing make like it sounded sense, so like it made sense. So she couldn't even write that. Right? But it proved to be true. Why? Because great leaders, and now we know that the Rebbe, by the way, you could probably say was the most optimistic person in the world. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, I mean, they've written a book now called Positivity Bias, because he was so positive and so hopeful, and to him nothing was not overcomable and nothing couldn't be transformed. But it wasn't, because it was in denial. He used to call the world, he used to say, you can look at the world as a jungle or look at it as a garden. I choose to look at it as God's garden, as a beautiful place, a place where there can be growth, vibrancy, vitality. And you almost think like, which world is he looking at, right? But that was his whole perception, that was his whole philosophy. But not because he didn't deny the problem, because he saw the problem. He realized the problem and he detected the problems a lot of times earlier than other people. And he said, there is a terrible problem here. He noticed the way Jerusalem was conquered and the language that was being used by the military at the time, that there was almost an insecurity, which wasn't noticed at the time, but there was an insecurity that maybe we should give this back. And God forbid, I mean, Baruch Hashem, this hasn't happened, but there's been discussion about giving back parts of Jerusalem or even some of the holy sites, right? Terrible stuff. Then it was considered insane, but he detected the insanity not because he was negative, because he was positive. And that's why we talk, and Elie Wiesel talks about recognizing insanity. We need to recognize insanity. And we need to recognize insanity on time before it's too late. This is true on a global level. It's true on a national level. And it's true with ourselves. You know, Pirkei Avot, the ethics of the fathers tells us that Al Talmin Atzbachad Yom Matach, if you're going really well, if your personal growth is going fantastically, your spiritual growth is going amazing, you think you're on the right track, you think you've overcome your own temptations, you think you've overcome your own weaknesses, your struggles, your personality issues, don't trust yourself until the day you pass on. Because you never know what can creep in. You never know that little insanity that's within you could raise its ugly head. It could you could slip. You could be influenced. Someone you could suddenly find yourself in a social culture, in a social setting where the influences and the antithesis of what you believe in, and suddenly before you know it, your thinking can be changed. Your thinking can be completely colored and distorted, and you'll land up in a completely environment of craziness. You say, "How did I do this?" And it'll be too late because you won't be able to fight it. We need to recognize bad. We need to recognize things which are spiritually threatening. We need to recognize things which are from a social point of view and a tolerance point of view and an evil point of view, unacceptable, recognize them within ourselves, recognize them within our communities, and don't normalize it. And recognize it on time, even if it makes us look crazy. See, the problem is because, as I said before, Kabbalistically, we have good and evil is embedded in everything. So though we are intrinsically at the very heart and core of our essence, we are good. But nevertheless, we are also mixed in with problems. And the struggle is always on. And we should never get distracted. We should never take our eye off the ball. And we should never think that things are okay, because they're not. As we see today, things which we see today in the world, things which would have been unheard of 20 years ago, be it anti-Semitism, be it Holocaust stuff, be it just disrespect, just general social dysfunction, things which are unheard of 20 years ago are so rampant now. And we should never normalize it. We should detect it and try to detect it on time and do something about it. Which leads us to the next step. The next step is not just recognizing it, but it leads us to the concept of the prohibition of silence and indifference. That when we recognize something, and we are fortunate to recognize something for what it is, we are not allowed to be quiet. Now, it's a complicated topic, that, because not always we have to go around denouncing everything that's bad, right? Because it should never come from a negative context, but we need to speak up. People need to speak up. It's not always easy, especially when it's unpopular. But protesting insanity is so important, despite the fact that protesting insanity often seems as insanity itself. Right? You know, go back to the story of the beadle, Moshe the beadle, who came back and he's trying to tell everyone about the mass killings of Jews. And Elie Wiesel says something so beautiful which we can take to every situation. He says, it's illegal to shout fire in a crowded theater. But if there is a fire, it's immoral to remain silent. Right? And at that time, there was a fire, he continues, so Moshe shouted. One must raise an alarm in such a moment, even though it will be perceived as an act of a madman, even though it makes people uncomfortable. And that was the reaction of Moshe. It's an amazing metaphor. It's illegal to shout fire in a crowded cinema, but if there is a fire, it's immoral to remain silent. Right? You see, when there is insanity, when there is immorality, when there is some things that are going on wrong, whether it's in our community, whether it's in our country, whether it's in the world, we just don't have the luxury of remaining silent. The common human disposition is to say, whoops, I'm not getting involved. It's not my problem. I'm not getting involved. But it's not, it is our problem because we have a collective responsibility. We've talked about this many, many times. We have a moral responsibility to respond. And if we don't respond, first of all, we have a moral responsibility. And second of all, we never escape the problem because if we don't respond, ultimately it becomes our problem. So it's just a matter of time. Now, let's just talk about silence for a moment, right? We know silence is a very good thing on one hand. Silence is often glorified. The Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers, tells us that Seyag L'Chochma Shtika, the fence, the pathway to wisdom is to remain silent, because silent we can listen, we can absorb. Silent we can reflect. Silence has a number of beautiful, beautiful attributes to them, right? But silence isn't always a good thing. I think I've told you the story before, but I once heard from an elderly gentleman who told me a story, but when he went once to see the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he had an audience with him, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe asked him to share some information, which was very important, and he was uncomfortable sharing the information. And he didn't know in presence of the Rebbe how to get out of it. So he said, he quoted to the Rebbe in jest, he said, you know, the Talmud says, as the saying in the Talmud, Mila besela shtika betray, which means that a word is worth a coin, but silence is worth two coins. And the concept of the Talmud there was to glorify the concept of silence. In other words, to say, silence is golden. Silence is worth more than speaking. So the Rebbe smiled and says, yes, but you have to understand, when the Talmud says a word is worth a coin and silence is worth two, you can only be silent one time. If you speak, every word is worth a coin, so the sum total is much more. What the Rebbe was trying to say is, yes, of course the Talmud is trying to tell us the virtue of silence, but sometimes you have to know that speaking up is worth more than silence, right? You see, because at very worst, sometimes we can think to ourselves, why speak up? No one's going to hear about it. No one's going to listen. Like no one listened to Moshe the madman, Moshe the beadle. No one listened to people often when they speak up. No one takes people seriously when it just seems outrageous and insane. If you face it, if you're calling out insanity, but you seem insane instead. So what's the point? You know, there's still a point. Because the point is that at least we maintain the sensitivity. See, part of what goes on is, you know, the power of a social group is amazing. The power of living in an environment where there's disrespect, where there's dysfunction, moral dysfunction or distorted thinking or bad values, is that even if we think we're not that way and we disagree, we become immune, we become desensitized. And when we become desensitized, we don't even know sometimes that we become influenced and desensitized. And therefore, sometimes speaking up, if nothing else happens from speaking up, at least we protect ourselves. You know, he says in the book, we study madness. Elie Wiesel says that we study madness in order to learn how to resist. Madness holds the key to protest, to rebellion. Without it, if we are too sane by the standards of our surroundings, we can be carried along with the world's madness. And then he goes on to tell a beautiful story, and I'm going to read it to you. Obviously, it's a made-up story, but it's a story, right? Using the town Sodom and Gomorrah as a metaphor. And we know Sodom was a very evil place. So listen to a story, he says. One day, a just man came to the city of Sodom. He began to preach to its inhabitants, telling them to change the evil ways. He wanted to save them from destruction. a destruction he knew would come as a result of their sins against one another. "Please," he said, "stop your cruelty, stop your inhumanity. You must be kinder to the stranger, to the children of the stranger." He went on like that for many days, but no one listened. He did not give up. He continued preaching and protesting for many years. Finally, a passerby asked him, "Rabbi, really, why do you do that? Don't you see no one is listening?" He answered. He said, "I know no one will listen, but I cannot stop. You see, at first I thought I had to preach and protest in order to change them. But now, although I continue to speak, it is not to change the world. It is that they don't change me." Right? Another very, very important part of speaking up. It's really important never to become desensitized to the madness of the world. Never to become insensitive to things that are wrong, that go on around us, to the egocentricity, to the self-centeredness, to the disrespect, to the dysfunction, to immorality, whatever we're noticing, whatever we could be noticing that could be going on around us, never to normalize it, never to become desensitized to it. And if we need to speak up, if the only purpose and the only benefit of speaking up is at least that they don't change me, that is also good. Because we need to stay strong, because you never know the influence that we could have. And the truth is, it's not just about changing ourselves, because when we change ourselves, we set an example and we breathe light. And we breathe light, we never know the effect that we could have. We never know doing good and fighting evil, what effect it could have and how impactful it actually could be. I wanted to share with you an insight, and I might have shared with you a number of years ago, I'm not sure. But an insight, which is an amazing insight about the negativity of remaining silent. I need to give you a bit of context. It's an insight that comes from a great Sephardic sage of the 18th century called the Chida, Rab Chaim Yosef David Azulai. It's quoted in one of the essays of Rabbi Yossi Jacobson. And he says the following. You know, a few weeks ago we read in the Torah about the two sons of Aaron. Aaron was a great high priest, Moses' brother. And we read about the two sons of Aaron, Nadav and Avihu, how they both perished. They were punished by God and they both died. So there's lots of explanations on why they died, but there's a very sort of cryptic midrash that needs to be decoded on why they died. So it says the following. It once happened, it says the midrash, that Moses and Aaron were walking along the road to Nadav and Avihu. They were walking along the road, and Nadav and Avihu, the two sons of Aaron, were walking behind them. And behind them, the nation of Israel. So Nadav turned to Avihu in disrespect of Moses and said, "When will these two old men die and you and I can take over and succeed them and lead the generation?" To which God responded, "We'll see who outlives who." And as a result, they were punished. Now, the Midrash continues, a very, very strange Midrash. In other words, so the Midrash is telling us that Nadav and Avihu died because of the disrespect that they uttered and they said in disrespect to Moses and Aaron. So the Midrash continues. You know, there was an individual called Job, the book of Job. The book of an individual who suffered tremendous suffering through his life. There's all kinds of explanations of who it was. It's not clear. According to this Midrash, it says like this. It says, when Job heard about the death of the two sons of Aaron, and he heard about why it happened, he had insight into why it happened because they disrespected Moses and Aaron, he started to tremble, it says. He became afraid. What's he got to do with that story? So listen to what this Chida, the Sephardic sage, explains. It's brilliant. And he says the following. He says, there's a different midrash that tells us, the Talmud says it in fact, that Pharaoh in Egypt had three advisors. Jethro, who eventually became Moses' father-in-law, he was a convert. Eov, Job, and Bilam. And Pharaoh convened a meeting one day, and he says, we have a problem. The Jewish nation is here, the sons of Jacob. They are multiplying, they're becoming a threat. We need to do something about them. So Yitro objected oppression. He said, no, they're good people, they're moral people, we're not allowed to do anything to them. Pharaoh wanted to enslave them, he wanted to oppress them, he wanted to persecute them, and Jethro spoke up and protested. Bilam, he said, yeah, that's a great idea. Bilam was an evil person, later became an evil prophet. He says, that's fantastic, he supported, let's persecute them, let's enslave them, let's do whatever they can. And Job Job remained silent. He was quiet. Completely quiet. Didn't say anything. Didn't get involved. What happened later, says the Medrash, Jethro, who protested, he was rewarded by God and became Moses' father-in-law. Bilam, who supported the idea, openly supported the idea, he was killed eventually by the Jewish people. There's a whole story in the Chumash. Eventually it was a war and he fell. Job, says the Medrash, ended up leading a life of suffering. Now, he remained silent. Jethro actually had to run away from Egypt and hide in Midian. Job was okay, he remained silent, but Bilam became a big guy, big shot, and eventually he died. So let's take ourselves back. Job and Yithro and Bilam are walking in the street. And you just imagine what Job is thinking to himself. What stupid people. Why do they have to get involved? Yithro is going to have to run away. Bilam now is supporting evil. Why get involved? Why speak up? I was the smartest of the lot. I kept quiet. However, Job hears that Nadav and Avihu were punished, the sons of Aaron. Says the Medrash, he heard they were punished and he started to tremble. Why did he tremble? Because he heard they were punished. Why they were punished? Because the Medrash says that Nadav said to Avihu something very disparaging about Moses and Aaron. But if you look at that Medrash, something strange happens. Nadav said it to Avihu. So who was the disparaging one? Who disrespected Moses and Aaron? Only Nadav. Nadav said to Avihu. Avihu didn't say anything. So why was he also punished? And Job heard this story and he said, I know why he was punished. He remained silent. Silence is worse than even agreeing. Silence is indifference. Silence breeds evil. Silence lets evil happen. Silence lets evil thrive. And Avihu was not the one that was disrespectful, but he was the one that remained silent. And when Job heard that, he started to tremble. He says, I'm in trouble now. I thought I didn't do anything bad. I thought I just stood at the side, didn't get involved. But I did. I remained silent. When Pharaoh spoke up and he wanted to persecute the Jewish nation, I remained silent. I just didn't get involved. And you know, globally, that's what's happening now as well. We know that there are those that support anti-Semitism in so many terrible ways. There are those that stand up and protest. There are those that agree, like Bilam. And then there's a large population of the world that just remains silent. And that silence is evil. And we have to fight that silence. But it's not just a global thing. I'm not just talking philosophically about global issues. I'm talking with ourselves. When we see something, we cannot remain silent. Now, of course, that's a difficult thing. Because nor do we want to become the world's biggest pontificating saint, you know. Not everything you see, you have to speak up. Not everything you see, so, that's not wrong, that's evil. Obviously, it's got to be done in a smart way. It's got to be done it's got to come from a good place. It cannot be to put other people down. It's got to be done respectfully. Each situation is so different. Now's not the time to discuss that. But the principle is there. The principle is that we have to recognize badness, we have to recognize insanity, and we have to do something about it and speak up. How do we speak up? This is the point. It's not always about speaking. It's not always about saying things. How do we protest? How do we do what Elie Wiesel calls the rebellion against madness? How do we do that? So yes, education is certainly one of the things. We educate ourselves. We talk about it. We talk about good things, but it's much more than that. Because the truth is, education is not enough. Rational explanation is not enough. So here I want to go to something else Elie Wiesel says that's so beautiful. When he talks about the different areas of madness and insanity, he says there's individual madness, there's political madness. And then he goes on and he says there's something called mystical madness. What's mystical madness? Someone asks him. He says mystical madness is the obsession with humanity and redemption, with the union of people. It's the messianic element in human life. One must be mad to believe that we can make the world a better place, that we can save humanity or even a single life. It might be unreasonable, irrational, but I am for that madness. That's an amazing concept. In Kabbalistic sources, in Hasidic sources, there's a concept they talk about like this. You know, how do you say foolishness in Hebrew? It's called shtut. Shtut means madness or foolishness. The Talmud says that when a person transgresses, a person does something wrong, really a person wants to do right, but you know, wrong is always irrational. So when a person does something that's immoral, it's a shtut. It's really a moment of insanity. So when we do things wrong, that's why it's good that it's appropriate that Elie Wiesel refers to the evil in the world as insanity, because the truth that's in line with what the Talmud says, that evil is insanity. I mean, rationally we should be moral people. But insanity means we deviate from insanity, we deviate from the rational, I mean, and we do bad. But in the Kabbalistic sources, there's something called shtut the klippa and shtut the kedusha. There is insanity of evil, and there's the insanity of holiness. In other words, like this. You can fight evil with talking about it, with education. You can explain why evil is evil. You can rationalize it. You can give proofs. You can talk about things in a rational way. But the truth is, that's not how you fight insanity. You fight insanity with insanity. You become crazy for the good. What does that mean? It goes back to what we spoke about last week. Insanity, holy insanity, or what he calls mystical insanity, is living with passion, living with conviction, living with faith, living with the fire of the soul, living with hope, living with belief and confidence to the point where it's insane. To the point where it seems like an impossibility. Having dreams, having determination of changing and bringing good to the world, which could on the surface look completely crazy. And maybe you never will change the world, but you'll change part of the world. And each one, step by step, good is a contagious as well. Light is more powerful than darkness. The way you fight insanity is not by the head. You fight insanity with insanity. By being overly passionate about good things, by setting an example with enthusiasm, with excitement of good, by talking about values, by living values, by causing an excitement, by creating a fire around the concept of goodness, of holiness, of morality, of functional living, of valuable living, of purposeful living, of meaningful living. Going back to that audience that Geula Cohen describes about an audience with the Rebbe, they got talking about the youth. That the youth are in trouble today. This is back in 1967. That's so much true today. But and the Rebbe said that now we need to bring in radical measures. And he was talking about something crazy, that he was talking about how we need to deal with the youth, and she didn't understand. And the Rebbe turned to her and said, "You gotta fight fire with fire. When a fire is raging, you gotta bring in an opposite fire, you gotta bring in the fire of holiness, the fire of morality. And we have to believe that we can make a difference." That in itself is insanity. Because if you think about it too rationally, we'll think, no, it's better just to crawl into our own little hole and just do what we can and sort of live it out. But no, we need to recognize negative insanity and be insane enough to call it out and to fight it in positive ways, in optimistic ways, in hope, not negative ways, in hopeful ways, in determined ways. We have to fight the negative madness with mystical madness, with holy madness. You see, because if we just do it on a rational level, our commitment to morality in a rational context, our commitment to good living and meaningful living just in a rational way, it's just not going to be enough. We need to uncover that fire, that faith, that determination, that hope that we really all have, and let it be obvious, let it be shown. Let us believe in people. Part of that insanity. Let us believe that intrinsically people aren't evil. Let us look at another person and say, that person, forget it. I'm never going to change that person. Let's not say that. Let's believe in the human being. Let's believe in the intrinsic goodness of the human being. Let's look at a person that perhaps we could, it's within our circle of influence, and perhaps we could inspire, and never turn away and say, too far gone. It's just mad to think I can change that person. It's mad to think that I can inspire her, or I can uplift him. No. Let's fight insanity with insanity. Let's believe so much. And these are the great people, going back to the people who understood evil, recognized evil. Elie Wiesel, in his way, after the war, he set out to change the world. Did he succeed? You could argue he didn't, but he did. Because he raised awareness. He changed some people. And those people changed others. And there's a ripple effect. The Kloisenberger Rebbe that I mentioned last week, when he came after the war and he had lost a wife and 11 children, his entire family. And he should have just given up. A sane person would have said, just quit. And he refused. He said, no, I'm going to rebuild. And at the time, the rebuilding seemed completely crazy. And he did. The previous Lubavitcher Rebbe writes when he came in the middle of the war and he was rescued from the Nazis and he came to America, and within 24 hours, he writes in his diary, he wanted to set up a yeshiva and raise Jewish awareness and fight assimilation and bring goodness and kindness and holiness to the world. And he writes that he cried that night because his own good friends who he knew from Europe pulled him into a room and said, Rebbe, it's not Europe here. It's America. It's different. We'll set you up. Don't worry. You'll live out your days. You only live another 10 years. You'll live out your days in peace. We'll set you up with a little shtibble. You have a couple of followers. You have your minion. Just play it low key. And they weren't bad people. They meant well. They were just approaching it rationally. And he said, absolutely not. I want to establish a yeshiva school, which was insane at that time in America. Within 24 hours, it was established. And then he continued the whole mass movement. And today, the movement, as you know, is worldwide in the most far-flung corners of the earth. Right? But it's true on every level. You never know what one thing could bring. You never know what just a bit of hope, a bit of determination, a bit of insane optimism can actually breed. We have to recognize insanity, evil insanity, and fight it with insanity, with that craziness, with that inner hope, with that just amazing belief that we can make a difference. Not that we have to go and fight the whole world, but we can make a difference one person at a time, and that we will make a difference, and that good that we do is eternal, and the good that we do is impactful, and you never know who we can change. If we made one person's day better, we never know which life we can save and whose life they could save, and what the ripple effect is of all the generations. I'll tell you a little story, a beautiful story. I knew his family. I might have told you this, but you know that insanity comes from the deep-rooted, irrational part of who we are—the soul that just has this craving for meaning and purpose and faith and just the fire, the spark of our soul, essentially, which is way, way above logic, right? So there's a story of a yid called Rabbi Yochanan Gordon. Rabbi Yochanan Gordon lived in the same town as my grandfather, the town of Dokshisi. My grandfather left before the war. So did Rabbi Yochanan Gordon. Rabbi Yochanan Gordon also lived before he left before the war, and somehow he made it to America. Unfortunately, there was a community left there, and there was a rabbi called Rabbi Leib. Rabbi Leib was a very, very beautiful, very, very special person, a great pious, saintly rabbi who was the rabbi of this little town. And he was caught when the Nazis came and raided the town. He came and he was with everyone. They were all rounded up, and they were put into a synagogue. And it was very clear what was going to happen. The Nazis were about to light a fire and burn down the whole shul with everyone in it. And he, when they came there, he was actually in the middle of davening because it was in the morning and he used to daven extra long each day because he was a very pious person. And suddenly he looked up and he realized what's happening. And suddenly he opens up his eyes and he turns to the whole community and he says to them, Rabbeisai, says, my fellow brothers and sisters, we're about to perish, it seems, sanctifying God's name, called Kiddush Hashem. It's a mitzvah. Let's do it with hope. Let's do it with joy. And he started to dance. And he started to inspire everyone. And the Germans, unfortunately, got so upset that they shot him. Now, there was one particular person who miraculously managed to escape. It was a whole person. Actually, it's a funny story. He needed to go to the bathroom. And someday, he climbed out of a window. And actually, he saved. He was the only one in the town. And eventually this guy made it to America, this young person. And when he came to America, he met up with Rabbi Yochanan Gordon, who was the old colleague from Dokshisi. And Rabbi Yochanan Gordon was so happy to see him. And he asked him to please tell him what happened to the town. And he tells the story, and he tells the story about how this rabbi in the town of Dokshisi eventually started to dance. And he inspired all people, and he actually, unfortunately, tragically got shot. And then this person who was a bit of a skeptic, he turned to Rabbi Yochanan Gordon and he said in Yiddish, I need to give you the background here. In Yiddish, when you say someone's crazy, the word in Yiddish is arop fun zinnen, which means he's gone down from his mind. Meaning like he's lost his mind, but it means like he's taken a step down from his mind. So he said to Rabbi Yochanan Gordon, he said, Ich mein, he says, I think that in the last few moments, the Rav is arop fun zinnen, that the rabbi lost his mind. In those few moments, but he used the Yiddish expression "arop von zinnen," down from his mind. So Rabbi Yochanan Gordon said to him, he said, "Nay, nay," he said, "No, no, no." I'll say in Yiddish and I'll translate. He says, "Nicht arop von zinnen, nor aruf von zinnen." He didn't go down from his mind; he went up from his mind. He connected with his faith. He connected with his inner soul. He connected with who he really was, and he said to them, no matter what's going to happen, my eternity doesn't go away. Who I am, my soul, my identity, what I stand for will never be killed, because I'm eternal and my soul's eternal. He didn't make it, unfortunately, but his spirit was so eternal and inspired everyone in those last moments to give up their life for the sake of God, but not tragically, to do it with hope, to do it with joy. So he says, no, the rabbi didn't go down from his mind. He went up from his mind. We don't need to die, God forbid, but we do need to reveal that same insanity. We need to go up from our minds. We need to be crazy. We need to be hopeful and optimistic and believe and have faith and trust in God and in the human race above logic, so that we really believe that we can make a difference. But we also need to do something about it. We can't just remember. We can't just identify insanity. We can't just speak up and say it's going to be okay or inspire people. We need to actually do something about it. We need to actually take steps and say, what am I going to do? How am I going to live opposite? How am I going to inspire? How am I going to teach people in a nice way, in a positive way? What am I going to do? Which discussion group am I going to hold? Who am I going to have a discussion with? Who am I going to try and inspire? Because the Torah always tells us that when you have a nizkarim, when you have memory, you must translate that memory into action. So yes, the steps are as follows. Just to summarize, the steps are, because we're running out of time, so I'm going to make this brief. The steps are, we need to first of all not normalize insanity. We have to be sensitive to it. We have to call it what it is, and we have to recognize it. We have to recognize it and speak up and not be silent. And then we have to fight it. How do we fight insanity? With insanity. With the innermost irrational parts of who we are, by believing that we can make a difference. And then we have to take that belief and put it into action. Put it into, educate people and put it into action and do things which are good. Have a list, have a goal, have a plan of what are we going to do to bring morality to the world? What are we going to do to spread it? Each one of us can do something. We don't delegate this to leaders or to activists or to communal leaders or to rabbis or anything like that. It belongs to each. It's the responsibility of each person. It's the responsibility of each person. No one can be silent. None of us can be silent. We all have the responsibility to fight the insanity that exists in the world. To recognize it does exist. Speak up. Have the irrational positivity coming from the depth of our soul, the mystical insanity, to fight it and to actually make a plan to do something about it. We need to ask ourselves the question, what are we doing to inspire others? What are we doing to make a difference? Might not be the whole world, but might make a little bit of a difference. Might be to a friend, might be to a child, it might be to just to someone that we know, might be to a group of people. What are we doing to make that difference? That's the formula. I want to just, as I said, tomorrow is so connected, Yom Yerushalayim is so connected to the capture of Jerusalem. So I'm just going to explain. I want to share with you just one final insight, which is very, very beautiful. You know, in Israel, there are four cities that are considered holy cities. And they are the city of Jerusalem, the city of Tveria, the city of Tzfat, and the city of Hebron. And the mystics tell us that they correspond to the four elements within the person. The fire, water, wind, air, and dust. Why is that? Yerushalayim is a city of fire. It's a passionate city. We know there's something about Yerushalayim. People come away all excited and passionate. We know that it was the seat of the altar of the Beit HaMikdash, the temple where there was sacrifices and fire. Tveria is the city of water. There's resorts there, but also was a city of Torah knowledge, which is considered knowledge. Torah learning is compared to water. Tzfat is a city of air. Number one, it's an airy city, but also it's a mystical city. Air being the most untangible of the four elements. It's like it's wind. What is it? It's sort of mystical and secretive. And Hebron, which is basically a city of dust. It's a very dusty city, and also was a city of cemeteries. That's where our patriarchs are buried and so on and so forth. A city of dust. But the mystics tell us that how we live, it's not only four cities in space, it's also four cities within ourselves. The holy four cities have to work like this. We have to understand who we are. Number one, we have to have the city of Tveri, we have to have the city of water, because we cannot fight bad in the world until we become educated. We have to learn. We have to discuss. We have to have discourse. We have to study. We have to study values. We have to study meaning. We have to study purpose. We have to study personal growth. We have to discuss these things and educate ourselves. But studying is not enough, and rationality is not enough. We have to have that fire within us. That's Yerushalayim. And not only do we have to have that fire, we have to dig very, very deep into Tzvat. We have to go to that mystical side of us, the irrational side of us, the mystical madness, as Eliyahu Zal calls it, that's inside of us, and unearth it and nurture it and ignite it so that we actually can be passionate and excited about bringing those values and those goodness and making a difference to the world. But then we should never only be abstract and theoretical, we have to bring it down to action. And action is tachlis, like the dust of the earth, the actual physicality of the earth. Bring it down into purpose and do something about it. And do something about it means not to do wonderful, amazing, world-changing things. But we have to believe that the world could change, but what we do has to be one action at a time. Let's wake up each morning, let's come each day and just fight madness with a bit of madness, but ask ourselves the question, how am I translating my madness? What am I doing today to be mad? Good mad. What am I doing today to make a difference in goodness, in kindness, in morality, in lifting someone else up, in bringing holiness and goodness into the world? So that's just some highlights from this chapter. We're going to continue on again, just for those who came in a bit late. Next week is Erev Shavuot, so there's no session. So we're going to resume again for a few more weeks. There's 3 more weeks to this series, the 3 last chapters, but it will happen start again in 2 weeks' time, 4 3 weeks. I wish everyone an amazing day. Be crazy, it's good, and do something about it, and only good things. I've unmuted you so you can ask a question. Or you can...
Thank you, Rabbi.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you very much.